Hello, I'm Andrew Tuck, and you're listening to The Urbanist on Monocle 24, the show all about the cities we live in. In this episode, it's our best of 2018. We've looked back over the past 12 months to fish out some of the most colourful reports and insightful interviews here on The Urbanist. And we even have time to fit in a little game show.
No, I'm gonna have a guess.
Okay, go for it.
France. That's my guess.
Judges?
Oh, no!
Close. It was in Netherlands.
Stay tuned as we unwrap the year that was on The Urbanist, right here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. And to start this grand tour of the year on The Urbanist, we turn our gaze to the United States, where earlier in the year, New York City recorded the lowest number of homicides in the modern era. The figures are down by 12.5%. In 2016, there were 335 murders in the city, down from 290 the previous year. And this drop in crime was more generalised too, with fewer shootings reported as well. But while New York has reasons to cheer, other US cities have seen their numbers rise instead. To understand more about criminality, race and justice in the American cities of the present, I spoke to Brenton Mock, who's a staff writer at CityLab.
There was definitely a dip in the homicide rate and the violent crime rate in Chicago between this year and last year. There was a 12% decrease in murder in Chicago. That's not an insignificant number. That said, you know, Chicago is still near the top of the list in terms of major cities and murder rates. There were 765 murders in 2016. That dropped to 675 in 2017. It's good that they had a 12% drop, but that's still really high, you know, especially compared to basically every other city in the United States except for Baltimore.
Now, another city you put the spotlight on just in that same tone is Washington, D.C., where there was a 23% plus drop in the homicide rate. So again, I don't want to get too caught up in just running through numbers, but as you look at this patchwork of cities, is it just policing? Is it just whether they're targeting particular communities? Because within the same state, you give, again, some numbers in Texas. You have cities where the murder rate is climbing and where the murder rate is falling. When you went through all these numbers, did you begin to think you could see the underlying causes in the various metropolises?
I think it's really hard to tease out the underlying causes, especially when you compare cities of different regions. I mean, the reason why crime fell in certain cities in Texas would not be the same as why crime fell in certain cities in New York. But we can say this, violent crime has been falling overall in major U.S. cities over the last 20 to 30 years. What we've also seen, if we just take the last 8 to 10 years, we've seen the unemployment rate drop considerably. So if we want to look at why violent crime has dropped over the last decade, we would be remiss not to mention the fact that unemployment is down, which we would presume you have more people participating in the workforce. And so the economic situation for many families in these major cities have improved. I think you also look, when you look at these major cities that did have problems with violent crime in the 80s and the early 90s, those would be the same cities that received a tremendous amount of resources from the federal government, sometimes from philanthropy, to kind of help them modernize, to kind of smarten up their strategies around how they would deal with crime, who specifically they would target, how that would be dealt with. Also, when you look at the last few years, you can look at just reforms in the criminal justice system in general, where a lot of people who were under the old regime, you know, they were arrested for a certain crime, they were incarcerated, and that was the end of the story. Over the last few years, because of criminal justice reforms, people are arrested, and there are services available within the criminal justice system that may divert them away from incarceration and might actually divert them to certain programs that could help them work training skills, mental health treatment, medical treatment, therapy, any kind of resources that might help these people get back on their feet. So that definitely cannot be ruled out. Also, I think culturally, there's a lot that has changed. You know, when you look at New York City, you obviously, I mean, you have to look at hip hop music and hip hop culture, which is usually attributed as a cause for violence. But when you look in the late 80s, early 90s of the hip hop movement, there was a strong anti-violence theme through a lot of the music during that time. There was an actual movement called the Stop the Violence Movement, which was led by KRS-One and Boogie Down Productions. That movement was signed on to by pretty much every major rapper that you can think of, particularly around New York City. And the music reflected this anti-violence message. They understood what crack was doing to the communities. They understood what police were doing to the communities. They also understood what gangs were doing to the communities. So they spoke out against this. And so with that movement, I think you start to see the drop in crime, which starts in the mid-90s. You can kind of see that being almost a reaction to what was happening culturally in a lot of these communities.
That was Brenton Mock, a staff writer at CityLab. We headed to Lisbon a couple of weeks later to attend a conference about urbanism and sound, architecture and acoustics, art making a noise, and all sorts of things that roar, hum and sing. This reporting made us think again about what makes up the soundscape of our cities and how often we don't even hear it. It's important to remember that architecture is not merely a visual thing. Sound is a principal player in how to make better buildings and therefore better cities. Here's a highlight of what we experienced.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Resonates.
Most people here don't pay any attention to it because it's just there all the time. And for a lot of people, maybe it's even kind of an irritating noise. To me, it's an iconic sound.
The building kind of takes hold in that or starting point and creates this almost physical evidence that culture could come out of nature.
All of a sudden, you're locating yourself, your consciousness in relationship to the object is part of breaking down the barriers that society has built up. So it's a kind of freedom. It's kind of moving forward, thinking freely about these things.
That's what his gesture was, to offer the piece to the city so it could be reenacted and could live here and would not just disappear.
I think that people don't necessarily realize how much sound affects them in everything they do. Suddenly, when they find themselves in a place of silence, they'll very quickly realize that some sound or noise was affecting them.
Coming back to something where you felt it was not moving that much, it was more in tradition, suddenly you have your own meaningful, almost a narrative or like physical evidence that the country has moved on.
What kind of experience do you want to create in the building? How does that relate to the street? And how does that relate to your journey going to and from home, if it's your place of work, for example, to try and create the journey to be the kind of journey you want it to be?
Now from pleasant sounds of a city to perhaps more jarring ones, emergency sirens. The city has often been seen as a place where bad things happen, especially crime. And while many are still the backdrop against which murderers, robbers and fraudsters act out their criminal pursuits, they've actually become surprisingly safe in recent years. For a special episode on criminality, our producer Carlotta Rebello hopped to this side of the glass to host the Guess the Siren game show with one very special and rather useless guest. It's me.
Andrew, thank you for bringing me to this side of the glass. It is quite an interesting thing to be able to bring you Urbanist's very own first game show.
Okay, well, I'm not sure I'm going to do very well because I was thinking about this. Obviously, the ambition is to kind of name the sirens from different countries around the world. And I wonder, because they make you jump and they make you move in different countries, but I wonder how much I'm actually attuned to the sounds. So I'm hoping that hopefully there'll be a bit of swagger if it's from like Latin America, or, you know, hopefully there's a bit of a musical ambition in them as well, but we'll find out.
So the rules are simple. We'll be playing 6 different emergency sirens from around the world, and Andrew has a list of 12 places, so he has more options than those of the sounds, and we need to see if the travels that he has been doing with Monocle through the years prove to be fruitful and he'll be able to guess the right siren. Let's start with number 1.
Well, I'm going to go with New York. I feel that's quite an American sound. Maybe I'm mistaken, but it feels like the kind of siren that you would hear in a kind of a movie that has a bit of a crisis.
Well, let's hear what the judges say.
Oh, no.
This was an easy one, Andrew. I was starting with the UK. That was London's Metropolitan Police.
This is going to go horribly wrong, isn't it?
Yeah, if you can't guess even the country where we're standing.
Okay.
This is going to be interesting. Let's go to number 2. No, more melodic, this one. I'll give you a hint if you want. Do you want a hint?
No, I'm gonna have a guess.
Okay, go for it.
France. That's my guess.
Judges?
Oh, no!
Close. It was in Netherlands.
Okay.
Maybe the third one is the lucky one. Let's move over. Now, this time, I'll give you the hint. First up, we're moving outside of Europe.
Oh, please let that be New York.
I don't think this is it. Judges?
Oh, no. So that must be Mexico.
That is Japan.
Oh my gosh, this is like an absolute nightmare.
Well, it might be quite a good sign. It means that you...
I've never been arrested.
Yeah, you haven't been arrested or had to be in an ambulance in any of these nations so far. So just need to pay more attention when you walk around the streets. I'm sure from now on you won't be able to miss them. Let's bring things back to Europe for number 4.
That has to be France, doesn't it?
I'm just going to laugh and let the...
No, I'm going to change my tune.
Okay.
Can it be Spain? Is that Spain? Oh, no!
One more option on this one. It's Europe.
Germany.
Oh. Finally.
Finally. It happened to me right in front of my face and I just... Anyway, carry on.
Let's move over to number 5 now.
I'm going back to France.
Judges?
Oh.
Yes, 2 in a row. And let's wrap up with number 6. I think you'll find this one familiar.
UK again, then.
No, not repeating.
New York.
Judges? Yes,
oh,
finally.
Gosh.
So, out of the 6 sirens that we had, Andrew got 3 correct. It's a pass. It's a pass, Andrew.
Now, on The Urbanist, we often look at our cities through the eyes of planners, architects, mayors, and even city aficionados. But in the 19th century, the way we used to be introduced to cities around the world was through the eyes of travelling artists, bringing back on their canvases their impressions of capitals far and beyond. Claude Monet, considered the father of French Impressionist painting, was no exception to this. Earlier in the year at the National Gallery here in London, visitors were able to enjoy an exhibition that zooms in on the painter's relationship with architecture, featuring more than 75 of Monet's paintings. Monocle's Eileen Goffin went to discover late 19th century Paris, London and Venice through the eyes of the artist.
When we think of the paintings of Claude Monet, typically we think of gardens, of water lilies, of beautiful bridges under weeping willows. But in the current exhibition at the National Gallery in London, Monet and Architecture, we see another side of the Impressionist painter's oeuvre.
It's remarkable that Monet had a career spanning 60 years, and for 50 years of those, he was repeatedly painting a real variety of buildings, from the most humble cabins on the edge of a cliff through to Rouen Cathedral. And he's using them in very different ways.
That's Rosalind McKeever, curatorial fellow at the National Gallery.
It's not necessarily about the characteristic of the architecture, but it's what the architecture can do for the structure, for the colour, for the balance of his painting. For example, when he travels to Bordighera, which is on the Italian Riviera, it's a sort of new tourist town, he paints not only the Città Alta, the old city of Bordighera, but also the new palace that had been built, and he uses that and plays those two structures off against each other. Another thing he does often is use colour. So, for example, red roofs of buildings is something that plays against the green of a landscape to give him a real exciting colour palette in a picture.
So, for Monet, architecture serves his painting. Through buildings and bridges, we can identify the location of the landscapes he painted. We recognize a village by its church or a city by its famous bridge. But it also aided Monet with composition, color, and interesting surfaces on which to play with light, a technique he became famous for.
He's interested in Paris from the late 1860s through to the late 1870s. So it's a sort of 10-year period where he's looking at Paris, which of course is being redeveloped by Baron Haussmann, and this very new exciting period for the city. And he's painting that repeatedly and seeking out these modern locations. So, for example, he's painting in the Boulevard Capucine, where he's using the street furniture that he finds there to structure his picture in a very confusing way that leads your eye through the space.
Monet's fascination with the architecture of the new modernity, of rapidly industrializing cities like Paris and London, only lasted a decade. After that period, we encounter more personal impressions of how Monet wanted us to see the city, or at least how he wanted to see it. And, as artistic freedom allows, he occasionally applied the art of editing.
He painted what he wanted to paint. So, for example, with the London pictures, when he's painting Charing Cross Bridge, from his view in the Savoy Hotel, Cleopatra's Needle is in the way. So he only includes it in two of the very many pictures he does of that scene. In the others, he completely edits it out. And we're very fortunate to have one of the pictures with Cleopatra's Needle in the show. But even with that picture, you can see that it's still in quite a sketchy state. He hasn't finished it off completely because you can see that he's not happy with that architectural inclusion within the work.
But even beyond editing the views, when we really start getting a glimpse of the city through Monet's eyes, is when he starts painting the cities of London, Rouen and Venice. Here he uses buildings for different purposes. So what are they, and what do they reveal about Monet's relationship to these cities? Here's Rosalind again.
In Paris, he's focusing on modern life. You get a lot of people in the Parisian pictures who are moving around often. You see them at speed. You get a sense that they're walking through the city. He's also painting train stations, so he's interested in how people are moving around the city in that way. With London, his interest seems to be more around the air in London, the fog, the smog, of course, in that period, and how that affects the colour and light that he sees when he's here. So we see it in a very grey, foggy tones of the Thames Below Westminster, a painting he makes in probably early 1871. But we see this really comes to life around the turn of the century when he comes back to London, stays at the Savoy, and makes the more colourful, very evocative paintings of the effect of colour, of light on the water of the Thames. Then finally there's Venice, where he travels in 1908, and completely unlike Paris, where the pictures are filled with people, in Venice there's hardly anyone there, which is an extraordinary thing, because in this period in Venice it was absolutely chock-a-block with tourists. So the idea that he's completely cut the people out gives a more mysterious, a very strange, otherworldly quality to those pictures, where he's going back to something he's done throughout his life, something he's done in London, where he's painting buildings reflected in water. So at the top half of the canvas, you have this very solid structure that he's producing, and then underneath it, a far more fluid, broken up, reflected version of that same building.
These paintings, representations of cities and their famous architecture, evoke a mood, eerie atmospheres that, while not realist portrayals of that city, tell a much richer story for the viewer.
A report there by Monocle's Yaline Goffin. Now, there's something magical about finding an old photo of a familiar place and seeing how much it's changed. It's a powerful reminder of the life that unfolded on the streets long before you arrived, and it helps us understand how rebuilding, disaster, or simply bad planning has shaped the city that you know today. On a sunny August day, we went down to Covent Garden to meet Clive Borsnell, a photographer who has one of the last known records of the hustle and bustle at Covent Garden Market, when it still sold fruit and veg.
When I started the project, and it wasn't really, yes, it was a project, but I didn't know the market was moving at that particular moment in time, because it was 1968, and they'd been trying to move the market since before the war. That's a slightly different story. And I was an assistant to a fashion photographer in Great Queen Street. I was living in Earl's Court, so I used to come to Covent Garden tube station every morning, walk through Covent Garden to Great Queen Street where the studio was. I can't remember why and how, and I'd always loved it, and I remember being brought up here as a child to get Christmas trees and that sort of thing at Christmas time. However, I can't remember the circumstances of why one summer's morning at about 4:30, 5 o'clock, 5:30, I was at the top of James Street, and the sun was shining up the western side of James Street, and there was the cigar smoke, there was the hustle and the bustle, there was carts, there were barrows, there were horses, there was absolute pandemonium and phenomenal camaraderie. And I just thought, this place is amazing. I've got to get it, I've got to... And so I stood there for quite some time, when all of a sudden there was a massive lorry horn, leaning on the horn, and the trucker leaned out the window and said, "Wake up, dreamer boy." And of course I suddenly woke up to where I was, top of James Street, get out the way, truck wants to move by. I walked down James Street and I turned left at the bottom and I walked round here and back out and up, and off I went. And I thought, I've got to get it. And to begin with, it was pretty short. I got short shrift from people. It wasn't unfriendly, but it wasn't friendly either. And I just, those days were very difficult insofar as that there were some wonderful things in front of me, but I wasn't getting it. And it was the atmosphere of the place, the attitude towards photographers, the attitude and my complete ignorance of the place. But day by day, slowly, slowly, it began to gel. Slowly, it began to take shape. Slowly, I was, oh, I've seen you before, mate. Oh, you were around me a lot. Oh, you were here two days ago. Oh, God. And it's pissing with rain and you're still here. And it took about 9 months to become accepted and to be ignored. And that being ignored was the beginning of my real work, by which time I had developed a real love of the place. And it was that whole thing of humanity and the exchange of goods and services in a very physical way.
It's 11:30 a.m. on the 14th of August, and during heavy rainfall, a motorway bridge collapsed in the Italian city of Genoa. 43 people died, and the region was brought to a standstill. 2 months on, we went back to Genoa to try to understand the consequences for the city. As the demands for accountability continue to grow, both City Hall and the citizens recognise that this is a chance to square up to Genoa's urban shortcomings and finally fix them. Here's a highlight from a powerful report by Monocle's Chiara Rimella.
Oddio! 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 Oddio!
Tragedia a Genova, crolla il ponte Morandi dell'autostrada 10, decine le vittime, almeno 10 dispersi. Per quasi 50 metri il viadotto è precipitato nel fiume.
I'm standing at the foot of what remains of the Ponte Morandi. It's so quiet around here because naturally the area's been closed off to the traffic. There's only a few parked cars. We've had to leave our vehicle behind. So the only way to get closer is by foot. It's quite an impressive sight because I guess the last time we saw images of this bridge, at least the televised images of this bridge that are in our memory, come from a day of rain and grey skies, but today the sky is completely blue. It's a fantastic, very warm day of autumn here in Italy. And the bridge is still, that what remains of the bridge still stands so tall above all of the houses here. It's impossible for anybody living around here not to see this at any given time whenever they look out of their balconies. There are houses around here that have been emptied, and today is the day when many of the inhabitants of these houses have been allowed to go back in for a few hours to get some belongings. It's an impressive thing, a ghostly sight. I can see them moving a carrier from a balcony up and down a ladder. They've obviously come to collect things which are now being moved down from the upper floors of this big building, literally a few feet away from the bridge. After all the traffic that we've encountered getting here, the silence is astonishing. Just the noise of trees being swayed by the wind and nothing else.
A report there by Chiara Rimella in Genoa. Well, that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. Join us next week as we recap the best of our tall stories. Thank you for joining us through 2018, and we hope that you keep us company through 2019 too. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Rabello, and it was edited by David Stevens. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, it's Petula Clark with Downtown. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
Downtown, just listen to the music. Brighter there, you can't forget all your troubles, forget all your cares, so go down.